And welcome back to hour number three of our program today. This is Dick Bertel. We're going to delve into radio history during this hour of our program with Bob Payne. Bob is a member of the Society of Broadcasting Historians, and we're going to be talking about radio history today. And this is a subject that's close to my heart. It's a different aspect of the subject of radio broadcasting that I normally talk about. We do a show called The Golden Age of Radio, Ed Corcoran and I, and we talk about the programs that were on the air. Bob and his group are not interested in the programs. They're interested in the stations and the stories behind those stations. Bob, how many of you are in the Society of Broadcasting Historians?
Well, Dick, we have right now two full-time members, myself and Michael Nadeau, and we serve as president and vice president, respectively. And we have part-time members that number about 10, scattered all over New England.
And you're interested in stories about radio stations, about stations that no longer exist, stations that were on the air at one time but have gone by the board, so to speak.
That's right. Right now I'm trying to get some information on the old Hartford Times station, WTHT, which left the air in 1954, sort of so that Channel 18 could come on. Because they use the same facilities.
That's right. Well, as a matter of fact, WONS and WTHT combined to form Channel 18 back in, 1954, somewhere in that area anyway. I wasn't in this market at that time, but I do know that happened. That shouldn't be so difficult to obtain.
Well, it's not that it's difficult, but we are not officially, of course, now, but we're a nonprofit organization. We're so nonprofit that we haven't even had the money to go through the legalities of effectively becoming that for tax-deductive purposes. So we don't have any treasury that we can go to the libraries and ask for copies of things.
Well, you know, I'm going to suggest something to you right now. There are people working right here who know of individuals who worked at WTHT and I'm sure that you can get some leads, and sometime you can drive up to Hartford and talk to some of the people who put that station on the air. Again, I was not in this area at that time, and if I'm correct, WTHT was 250 watts, so you couldn't hear them in the Stamford area where I lived. And WINF now has that frequency. But my point is that I was not familiar with the station other than to know for a fact that it was a very fine radio station. But there is a station that you say existed sometime during World War II in Cheshire, Connecticut.
Right. This is the story that we've come across. We know very little bit about the station except that it was in the Waverly Inn in Cheshire. The Waverly Inn, which now stands, is not the original. The original burned a number of years ago, and they rebuilt it. All we know, as I said, is that there was a station. There was one lady in Connecticut that apparently had something to do with it, but there haven't been any connections made or anything.
Have you talked to her?
No, not at this time, unfortunately.
And this was a commercial radio station?
We assume it was. As I said, all we know is that the station was on the air.
You know what's so hard to believe about that? And I told you this earlier, if you had a frequency in the early 40s, even if you were in a bad market, let's say, even if you were losing money, that frequency was worth so much that it would seem to me impossible to lose. You know, you'd sell it to somebody else, pending FCC approval, that sort of thing.
Yes, it would seem so, but there have been two or three stations that have just opened the mic one afternoon or one evening and said, "This is W such and such, now leaving the air."
Never to come back, huh?
That was it. There was one up in Bangor, Maine. It was also on the same frequency that THT was on. And one afternoon, January 30th of 1949, they opened the mic and said, "WJOR, Bangor, Maine, 1230 on your dial, now leaves the air." Cut the transmitter and tore the station down, sold it to a Waterville, Maine radio station, and I incidentally picked up the control board last year. I checked around, found the old station manager in Richmond, Virginia, and he said, "By golly, you've got our board."
Well, I suppose those things do happen. There have been a number of stations that have opened and closed here in Connecticut. I know that the Hartford Current had its own radio station back in the early 1920s and shut it down, I think, about 1923, somewhere in there. Now, there were other stations. I understand the WDRC is supposedly the oldest continuously run radio station in Connecticut, but you say there are other stations that preceded WDRC.
Right, none of which is on the air now. The first, as we have it, was WAAQ, and that was in the Bridgeport area. The second was WCJ, and that was in New Haven, owned by the A.C. Gilbert Company. The third was the Hartford Current station, WDAK, and that came on sometime around May of 1922. It was authorized in May.
And where was this station located?
It was in the Hartford Times, the Hartford Current building.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Interestingly enough, Herbert Hoover went in and did a broadcast. He did a speech, and they had the big Morning Glory horns, which was connected to the microphone, and you had to put your face about three-quarters of the way into it. And somebody took a picture of him. At that time, they were using the old flash trays with the powder,
mm-hmm.
and he very quickly finished his speech and came out of there and said, I hope they don't put these blank things in the in the Senate.
That's a great story. I didn't know they had microphones. I've seen some of the photographs of these stations, but I've never seen anything that quite rivals that. Are you interested only in stations in Connecticut or New England or throughout the country?
No, right now we're interested in all of the stations, but we're concentrating on, well, New England as far as AM stations go, and for FM and television, New England, New York, and New Jersey.
I want to talk to you about the signals from outer space, supposedly, in just a moment, and we'll do that right after this. Okay, let's get back to Bob Payne of the Society of Broadcasting Historians. Let's go back to the early 1920s. The story of the supposed signals from outer space.
Right. In 1921, one of the planets which is closer to us, Mars or Venus, passed closer to the Earth than it will in the rest of the century. And through an agreement, all of the radio stations on this planet shut their transmitters off for 5 minutes each hour. And during this time, an engineer at WOR by the name of R.I. Potel recorded some signals on film, which were supposed to be signals from outer space, and they were in the Morse code. The only letter that was recognizable was the letter S.
Now, why do they feel that the signals came from outer space? Are they sure that all the transmitters throughout the world were inoperative?
I don't think they can be definitely sure, because there's always somebody who'll say, this would make a good gag, and throw a carrier on or something. But it's very possible they could have come from outer space. There are signals that do come in. There are also signals that have been transmitted from the Earth that have somehow gotten through the Kennelly-Heaviside layer, which is during the day 150 miles rather, and at night 150 miles, and they've somehow gotten through and gone into outer space. And if you have a sensitive enough radio receiver, you could pick them up now.
You mean I could tune in Fibber McGee and Molly, right, if I had a sensitive enough radio receiver, because it's still moving out?
Yes, you very possibly could, or you could pick up the first broadcast from WTIC on February 10th, 1925.
That's amazing. Now, was any significance placed on the one intelligible letter that was broadcast, that was picked up by the WOR engineer, the letter S?
I don't believe so. I just read a very short paragraph on this. I do know all that's left of it now is in the Smithsonian Institute.
Do you know what letter was first transmitted by Marconi in 1901?
Yes, it was the letter S from Newfoundland.
That's right.
Right.
Could it be that some civilization far out in space was monitoring the Earth finally picked up radio signals which would indicate to them that this civilization had achieved a certain maturity, a certain stage of development, and were trying to communicate back to us in the only letter they had.
That's very possible. Not to sound like a religious nut or anything, but in the Bible, Christ said that I have sheep elsewhere, to paraphrase him. And, of course, in the Mormon faith, it is believed and practiced that there were two civilizations, one in the Western Hemisphere, at the same time Christ was in his ministry. So I am quite sure that there are other worlds, other civilizations on other planets.
Well, it's a fascinating idea, anyway. Now, something else I learned about that I didn't know was that there were itinerant radio stations in Connecticut, stations that would move around.
Right, we have on file a couple cases of this. I spoke with Alex Dubinetsky of WICH in Norwich. He is the chief engineer. And he told me that in 1926 or 27, there was a barnstorming radio station that came to the Waurigan Hotel in Norwich. And it's sort of a fantastic story. I don't recall all the details. But they came in for a month, they picked up, and then they left. The same thing happened in Waterbury. I'm not going to guess how many years ago today, but it was December 26th of 1927. 40 or so merchants got together and decided that they would sponsor a station which would give people an introduction to radio,
mm-hmm.
people in the Waterbury area. And the station came in, they went on the air for a month, and they picked up and left. We haven't been able to piece the two incidents together, but it seems pretty logical that there's some connection there.
Now, is there the possibility that they were one on the same station?
Very possible. The only thing that I can't figure out is how they got a license, because I would think they would have to have a certain town that they'd have to be licensed in.
I'm just wondering if perhaps they didn't bother to get one. You know, we have pirate stations operating in the world today, and what is the status of the radio station that was operating off Cape May, New Jersey last year?
That station, I believe, has been closed down. If I'm not mistaken, that's the one that our Vice President, Mike Nadeau, told me about. It was out of Media, Pennsylvania, WXUR, and it was owned by a minister, and somehow or other, the station was shut down by the federal government, and now I understand the ship he had been broadcasting off of has been seized by the government, so I guess he's sort of off the air for the time being.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have in front of me a booklet that was put out by WICC in Bridgeport, although this booklet says Bridgeport, New Haven, Connecticut. Affiliated with the Yankee Network, the Colonial Network, NBC Blue Network, and the Mutual Broadcasting System. I've heard of three of them. I've never heard of the Colonial Network. Do you know anything about them?
Yes, the Colonial Network was more or less the orphan network of the Yankee Network. The Yankee Network was out of the old WNAC in Boston, now WRKO. And I understand it went on in the late 20s. It was basically a news network. In 1933, there was a news war going on between the two networks and the newspapers, and they came to an agreement in the Biltmore Hotel, hence the name the Biltmore Agreement, that the wire services would give the networks 2 5-minute newscasts during the day, one not to be used before 9 o'clock in the morning and one not to be used before 9 o'clock at night. The Yankee Network went on the air from Boston, primarily, as I understand, to combat this, and became quite a thriving network until January of 1967. And as I recall, TIC was hooked up with that for, I think, either 6 or 12 years.
That may or may not be true. It is true. I'm getting a nod from Bob Downs, and Bob would know. Bob's been here, what, since 1944, somewhere in there. and then they changed affiliation, I guess, to WONS and subsequently to WGTH. I worked for that station.
And then they went to WTHT for a while also.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that network has been around. Now, the thing that I find interesting in this booklet of WICC's is that they had extensive studios in New Haven, and rather beautiful studios, typical of the 1930s. The outside decor could have been designed by a Hollywood set designer with the so-called, what is the term for Art Deco? I believe the style of architecture of the 1930s, similar to that of Radio City Music Hall.
Could you find that out in your Saturday morning program?
That's where I'm drawing from, as a matter of fact. Modern living. But the front door has three circular glass panels in it, and there seem to be illuminated panels all up the front of the building. And this was the exterior of WICC's New Haven building, with observation galleries and studios and so on. So obviously they did a great deal of broadcasting from New Haven.
Yes, I would estimate probably 45% to 55% of their broadcast time was from New Haven. The studio was located at 1110 Chapel Street, which later became the studios of WNHC Radio and then TV, and they have since moved to College Street. And the 1110 Chapel building has been torn down.
Now, your organization is interested primarily in the technical factors of radio stations. Is that it?
Well, the technical, actually anything pertaining to the station. We'll even go so far as to find out the phone numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I should
speak personally.
Well,
what about the programming?
Yes, we're trying to find program schedules. We'd like to find, if possible, recordings of some of the old programs, the station IDs, newscasts, any of the local programming. And realizing that this is going to be almost an impossible thing to accomplish, if we can beg, borrow, or steal studio facilities or establish our own, then we'll do as much research as we can and then try to recreate them.
I was giving a talk in stores at the university campus, actually at the parish of that marvelous, beautiful church where the campus is located, and someone pointed out the window and said, "Do you see that knoll over there?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "That's where the towers were for our radio station back in the 20s and 30s. He said, "My dad was the chief engineer. Do you know about a station up there?"
Yes, there were, in fact, two stations before their current, I believe it's WHUS.
It's an FM station
today,
right?
It's an FM station now. The original station was WCAC, and that came on around 1926. At that time, they were juggling frequencies and, in some cases, even demanding that stations show cause why they should stay on the air. Unfortunately, not having the funding behind them, the station at Storrs was caught up in this, and finally they just gave up after being juggled frequencies 10 or 12 times, including WTIC, WICC, WDRC, and WGBS.
They were all moving around?
The CAC was ordered to share time, and they were getting, if they were lucky, 1/7 of the broadcast time of each station.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know that WTIC shared time with WEAF in New York. You had to sign off at a certain time of the day. And I think that there are some stations in New York City that still do this. On the high end of the dial, they'll shut off at about 6 o'clock at night, and another station will take over for 2 hours. And this may not be going on anymore, but it was going on as recently as 10 or 20 years ago, I know. So it's not an ancient phenomenon, certainly.
Yeah, it's still happening. And there is one station in New York, which is, I'm not going to mention the name of it, but they're using an authorization from World War II, which allows them to stay on until 10 o'clock at night rather than 8 o'clock. And I still don't know how they're using this, but they're somehow doing it.
Mm-hmm. And then they must sign off.
Right.
We'll talk more in a moment with our guest, Bob Payne, of the Society of Broadcasting Historians. And if you'd like to join the conversation, because Bob would like to talk to you In the event that you're able to give him some information, the phone numbers are 527-4188 or Enterprise 9842 if you're in Springfield, Massachusetts. Interesting stations, and I'm sure interesting history from Springfield, or in Bristol, Connecticut. And we'll take time out for this. 14 minutes now before 1 o'clock, let's take our first call. Yes, your question.
Yes. With your guest, I distinctly remember WDAK.
Yeah?
In fact, I was in that studio. And it was located in the current building on State Street.
Mm-hmm.
And it had the transmitting antenna on the roof, and it could be seen from the street. It was a circular thing with, say, about four or five wires around it, strung between two poles on the roof. And it wasn't like a tower, you see.
Right.
It was just like the old-time radios that had a single wire strung between two poles.
Did you work for them, or did you just visit the studio?
Well, I performed on the studio.
Oh, I see. As a musician?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was very interesting in this respect that where we went up to perform, it was, I don't know, second or third floor, I don't remember which, the studio and the transmitter and the whole works was in one room. And there was a group performing before we were. And when they got through, we had to wait till they got out. And then we went in and got all ready and briefed the announcer, who I guess was the engineer too, on what we were going to do. And they used to say, stand by. And that meant wait until the next program is ready to go on. And there was no definite time for it to go on. The microphone was a telephone there that had a megaphone taped on.
Yeah.
To the mouthpiece, you know, it was the old-time hand phone and a separate thing for the ear. You know?
Right, right.
And so it had a megaphone taped on. And when we got all set and everything, the announcer announced us, and he fiddled around with the controls on the transmitter and picked up this phone and spoke into it, but spoke, you know, through the broad end of the microphone.
That's beautiful.
A megaphone, rather. And when we got through, he just stood the thing back up on top of an old upright piano. And we went ahead. When we got through, he announced the next number, and then it was again standby, or I don't remember, perhaps signed off or something, until something else was ready to go.
Well, We would like very much, I'm sure Bob would like very much to talk with you. We can't ask you for your phone number on the air for your protection. But, Bob, do you have a phone number where this caller could get in touch with you or an address?
Yes, I have both. My phone number is 573-8404, and the address in Waterbury is 164 Chestnut Avenue.
Maybe you could drop him a line. That would be very helpful to Bob.
Yeah, what is the number again?
573-8404.
844.
No,
8404.
04. Yeah.
I see.
Okay.
All right. I'll give you a ring, and if there's anything else I can tell you, I remember also the old TIC studios with heavy drapes around the wall.
Oh, yes.
And the announcers with fancy names. And nothing like Dick Pertell. They had, it sounded almost like Shakespearean actors.
Yeah.
The Camden Carl.
Yeah, that was the style.
It was more organized at that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also took part in the DRC when Mr. Doolittle was developing a stereo.
Mm hmm.
And it was called at that time binaural.
Binaural sound, yeah, that's right, yes.
And we used to broadcast with two mics and two tapes, we would record it. And the only thing that we had difficulty there is that if you made a mistake in what you were doing, and you couldn't just correct the mistake. You had to go all the way back to the beginning, otherwise the tapes would not coordinate.
That's right, that's
right. And one broadcast went on... AM, and one, and then another broadcast went, another mic went out through FM. And the first stereo meant you were going to use an AM radio and an FM radio.
Now, I've been involved in that type of stereo myself. Thanks very much for calling.
Yeah, it makes me feel my age.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much.
Right. Yeah, we used to broadcast that way in the 50s with experimental stereo programming. Yes, your question.
Dick.
Yeah.
I wonder if you're aware, if your guest is aware, that the call letters of that Waterbury station he mentioned in 1927 was WCWS, and it operated from the Waterbury State Armory. And after it shut down, it was during the radio show, the newspapers printed a coupon in the paper and asked the people designate whether they wanted a Waterbury radio station or not. Unfortunately, it was overwhelmingly against it, and the reason was that people said they would not be able to get their favorite New York station.
Oh, I see.
It was some time later, until before Waterbury had their first radio station, which was 1934.
Mm-hmm.
And I was connected with the Waterbury radio station for 25 years as an engineer. If your guest would get in touch with me, I can probably give him a lot of information on the first high-fidelity station, W1XBS.
Yeah,
oh, yes.
The point is that we can't use your address or phone number for your protection on the air.
If I could have his phone number,
okay.
I'd call him.
Okay, what's the number?
573-8404.
Okay, I'll be in touch.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
I might add that if anyone would like to get in touch with me, the best time would be Saturday morning or Sunday evening, because I commute to Groton on the night shift, and it's it gets a little tiring, and I'm not home that much.
But if they do call, they can leave their number. And
oh, definitely.
Right.
Definitely.
Okay, your question, please.
Well, I don't have a question, but yes, I do. This is my 50th year in show business. Does your guest remember WCAC?
Do you remember WCAC?
No, sir, I don't.
Let me bring you up to date. At that time, about 1924, it was WCAC, was Connecticut Agricultural College in Storrs, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it wasn't commercial, it was experimental, more or less. And we used to play, they had 10, 12-piece orchestra playing. They heard us as far away as Philadelphia. You know? That was pretty good.
It sure was.
I remember that. I had a lot of fun. And I'm also an alumni, or I guess that's what you call it, of DRC when they moved to Hartford.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I also was, now this will kind of date the time, I was interviewed to play at a sustained program on TIC, my partner and I, and we took the audition and we were put on the air, going to, but something happened, personal to my partner's family, we couldn't make it. However, at that time, they had the microphone on the arm of the chair, you know, that
mm-hmm.
round thing full of holes,
mm-hmm.
and those heavy, heavy velvet drapes. You know, it was like, I imagine it was somewhat like the inside of a mausoleum, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
The sound wouldn't move more than an inch. Now, that's a long time ago, around 1924-5.
Yeah, that's an effect that we're no longer after today, but that was the style, of course, in those days.
Oh, yes.
It deadened the sound completely.
And you do your programs now on the air with your windows open if you wish, and the street noises don't even bother you.
Well, you know, under certain circumstances, although a great deal of engineering does go into the design of a studio today, as a matter of fact, our studios today, I don't believe, can be paralleled with any other that I've ever seen. We have carpeting on the walls for soundproofing. And it is beautiful. It is absolutely beautiful and acoustically just marvelous to work with. But it doesn't have that dead sound.
Oh, it's reflective acoustic.
Yeah, well, but not too reflective. In other words, it does absorb enough to give us the effect we want, but not too much.
I remember I used to go up and open up DRC once in a while to put on a program of my own, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd walk along the carpeting and... as I reached for the brass doorknobs, I think it was the trust building way up Main Street there, in a penthouse.
And a spark would jump out at you.
I'd reach for the brass doorknob and whack, you know. Oh, so they took up the carpets.
I know it.
They should have changed the doorknobs. It'd been cheaper.
Right.
Thanks for calling.
Okay.
Right. Move along to another call. Yes, your question.
Oh, if he's looking for any more information on that Storrs radio station from the 30s days, I can refer him to someone who used to run it.
Oh?
There's a man in New London who's running a radio station down there now, who used to run it during the early 30s.
Oh, I see. What station is that in New London?
Well, it's in the Mohegan Hotel. I don't have the call letter.
You don't have the call letter.
No, that would be WNLC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, he's managing that, and he was running the story station in the 30s, I'd say, around 33 somewhere in there.
Good. I'm sure Bob can track that down, then.
Give him a lot of information.
Sure. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Right. You're getting a lot of information today, Bob. Yes,
sure.
Your question.
Hello. May I talk to Delman?
Yes, go right ahead. He's right here.
I just want to tell him. The old Harper Current station was on the second floor. At that time, I worked for the Harper Current, not as in radio, but I worked newspaper reporting. I had an amateur radio station, and I was interested in purchasing that station, so I went downstairs to on the second floor to see Mr. John Sadowski, the owner of the Harper Current at that time, the president, and he offered to sell me that station for $50.
I'll take it.
Well, here's the best part of it. That station had the old carbon mic, as a previous talk speaker said, with the megaphone attachment to talk in.
Yeah?
The generator was in the same room, and when you heard that station, you'd hear the generator going, the hum of the generator. They had their own generator.
Yeah?
And the elevators were going right in front of it. And when the elevator went up, you'd probably hear part of the elevator. We didn't have very good insulation in that station at that time.
It still was a bargain at $50.
Yes, but in those days, who had $50?
I suppose you're right.
The only thing I wanted for was a generator and convert it into a transmitter.
Oh.
Miami.
Can you imagine if you had that station today?
Yeah, how much would I have today, a million?
Yep, probably.
That's what I told my wife.
Yep. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, your question, please.
Hello. Your guest is there, Vic?
Yes, he is.
Yes, sir.
Not long ago, I came across a radio station, somehow by accident, on FM, with a kind of dirty language, and the music was even worse. It's like a rock station.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any kind of law against that?
Well, there is, yes, to a certain degree, depending, of course, upon the language. The FCC would want to be notified.
I couldn't believe it, really.
The FCC would want to be notified by you or whoever might have heard the broadcast.
I see. Well, it was a thing on every day, you know.
Yeah, well, that's something that they would want to know about. We're running out of time, though. Thanks very much. Right. And, Bob, thank you so much for being our guest today, and I think you've probably gained some clues here as to where to go next for your information, because this is what you're looking for.
Right, and another thing, as I said, we're hoping to set up a studio. It may be quite a project, but hopefully within the next year it'll turn out, and we'll be able to exchange some information, and we have a lot of things that we'd like to do.
Well, that's great. Incidentally, if you'd like to get in touch with Bob Payne, I'll give the number again. It's 573-8404 in Waterbury. He'd like to hear from you if you have the information that I know he wants. We're going to take some time out for news, and then we'll be back. This is WTIC in Hartford.
NBC Radio News, Frank Gorin reporting.